This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Times is hard, times is tough. Nothing's easy, it's all rough. There's not much right, so much gone wrong. All I can do is play this song. You're watching the news, it all looks bad. The worst half hour you ever had. What in God's name is going on? All I can do is play this song.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. This week's program is about schizophrenia, the state of hoping the system will crash before it kills the planet, while counting on all the usual creature comforts of home, jobs, and a well-stocked supermarket. Yes, I know the Western world is hanging in suspension. We're all waiting for the shopping to resume, for the economy to rebound, for the good life to return. Most politicians and the mainstream press promise it will go back to the normal process of chewing up and spitting out the last of the planet's goodness. Meanwhile, we go to movies like 2012, slurping up the scenes of the destruction of everything. Part of our secret selves hope it will all go down in flames or floods, even while we worry about our children having a decent life. You see how it goes? So, we'll start out with one of the most promising solutions I have heard about lately, a dream of a new economics coming from a British government advisor, Professor Tim Jackson.
Economic growth, in particular, is supposed to deliver us prosperity, is in a point of crisis. It's failed, actually, even in its own terms. It's failed to deliver good life across the world, and it is now in the process also of destroying the planet. So this question, can we get prosperity without growth, incredibly important. In a sense, the only important question to ask about our world and about the way that we think of the good life.
Right. Addiction to growth hasn't worked. The rich just get richer while the rest of us get poorer, not to mention the abject poverty of the majority of the world's people living outside that golden net of Western power. We've paved over our best farmlands, and we're still not happy. Tim Jackson says we can remove the cancer of growth and still survive with a new idea of what prosperity really is. He's one of the brightest of the new economists and a top-level advisor to the British government. Jackson's thick report to the UK, full of econo-talk, has been boiled down into a new book for the rest of us called Prosperity Without Growth. We're lucky to get him on the phone for an interview from Britain. The idea of changing our fossil energy system is overwhelming. At a major recession plus climate change, it all seems impossible. But Professor Tim Jackson says there is a way out of the impossible. He's written a hefty report for the United Kingdom government and now a book for the average person with a roadmap for a survivable future. It's called Prosperity Without Growth, Economics for a Finite Planet. Tim Jackson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Isn't it a bit daring to promise prosperity just as climate and the energy system and the economy all seem to be heading downward?
It's daring, yes, but it's also, I think, important. It's important for society to have a kind of meaningful goal and a meaningful sense of its own future and of progress towards that future. And I think the situation that you highlight, where everything looks like it's going downhill, is actually dangerous, not just because of all those difficulties, but because it's tempting in those circumstances actually to despair of a positive future vision. And when societies do that, actually bad things happen. So actually putting a positive vision on the table is kind of important at this point for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which is that hope matters.
Do we really have prosperity now, I could ask?
I mean, we have had a kind of prosperity of a kind. It's very materially based prosperity. We've had, until the recession, 50 years or so in the advanced nations of a kind of increasing incomes. But it's been prosperity for the few, really, and at the expense of often the many and indeed of environment, which means that we're buying today's prosperity by undermining our chance of it tomorrow. So it's a very narrow vision of what prosperity means, and that's part of what the report was pointing out, is that we've lived under this particular version of prosperity as ever-rising incomes, at least for the lucky few. and it just hasn't delivered the goods. It's not been shared fairly across the world. It's not actually necessarily making us that much happier. It's unstable in its own terms, as we've seen in the last year or so, and it's heading us towards an ecological cliff. So that's the challenge, and the challenge really is quite precisely to say, let's put in place a more realistic vision of a lasting prosperity.
And I think that's one of the things I like about your book, is that it doesn't put a rosy glow on things. You do tend towards realism about the problems we face. One of the chapters that caught my attention was the iron cage of consumerism. What do you mean by that?
I think in a way that's the most familiar thing to people living an ordinary life in an advanced nation such as Canada or the UK, is this sense that actually, I mean, two senses really, one sort of kind of set of discontents around our rather consumerist lives out of the mist, as it were, even in the face of the recession. Of course we care about our jobs, of course we care about our security, we absolutely concerned about our families, we're also concerned about, you know, our families into the future, our children and our grandchildren. Those concerns are all very real concerns, and yet at the same time, this sort of sense that they're not really being addressed by this rather materialistic consumerist society that we live in, with stuff flowing through our lives continually. And yet, and here's where the iron cage comes in, it's very, very difficult to get out of it. We find ourselves locked into, you know, day-to-day routines that turn out to be quite materialistic, patterns of interacting with other people that turn out to depend heavily on material goods, and even our own hopes and dreams really expressed through consumer goods and artifacts. And that's the nature of that cage for us, is that it's worked kind of well up to a point, but it's locked us into a particular way of life that isn't necessarily serving our best interests.
Well, given the growth in recent decades, a whole tribe of experts have almost laughed away the 1970s report limits to growth. But now I wonder, is that back?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it was very premature to laugh it away. And during the 1970s and 80s, we could dream in sort of technologically optimistic ways of overcoming all sorts of limits. And I think the lessons kind of through the 90s and the noughties has been actually that some of those limits were pretty tough, and the limits to growth guys back in the 1970s, they got it a little bit wrong, yes, for sure, and they are the first to admit that, but they didn't get it that far wrong, in fact, so that now we are faced with issues of energy security, oil security in particular, and we're faced with really tough limits in relation to some of the environmental challenges, climate change, biodiversity, the disturbance of nutrient cycles, and so on and so forth. And those kinds of limits, I mean, this is interesting as we move towards 20 years since the Rio conference and 30 years since Brundtland, the sense that we have, in fact, not made any of the progress we thought we could make when we lived under that rosy glow of technical optimism. And it's time to think a bit more realistically, a bit more sanguinely about the prospects and how we should face them.
Well, like George Bush, China is promising to reduce energy intensity per unit of production rather than overall emissions. Can you talk to us about the myth of decoupling?
Yeah, this is, it relates very much to that point about technological optimism. Why did we think we could overcome those limits? Because the system that we have likes efficiency. Efficiency is one of the things it prizes, so it likes to do more with less. And we have, if you look at the data, you'll find we have done more with less, in the sense that for each dollar of economic activity, for example, we've reduced our energy and carbon per dollar by at least a third over the last couple of decades or so, and that's sort of progress. But the trouble is that even as we do that, we get more efficient in terms of each dollar of economic activity. For as long as the economy is going up, the number of dollars is going up and up and up. And actually, if you look at the data, what you find is that the scale effect, that scale of more and more dollars, has outweighed the efficiency effect time and time again. So that even as we get more efficient, actually, we are producing more and more output, and we're not getting anywhere near our targets, and that's the real rub. I mean, it's it's very sad, actually, when you have pinned your hopes on efficiency as the way out of the muddle. But you have to look at that data. I think you have to take it seriously, and you have to realize that there's something more involved than just chasing efficiency gains.
Well, our guest, Tim Jackson, is Economics Commissioner on the Sustainable Development Commission for the UK government at the University of Surrey. He was also one of the first professors of sustainable development. On the side, Tim Jackson is also an award-winning dramatist for the BBC. Tim, Professor Bill Rees, co-inventor of the ecological footprint, also warns Western consumerism will kill off our life support system as it is now. Rees is calling for smart decline. Are governments ready to talk about that?
It's tough for governments. I mean, that's one of the clear lessons for me as an advisor, essentially, to the UK government. That's what the Sustainable Development Commission is here. It advises the UK government. And, of course, there's a great difference between giving advice and having it listened to, and no more so really than in relation to this report. It's very, very clear that the government found it quite difficult to handle. The interesting thing, though, is that it has somehow resonated, that the messages of the report have gone out much more widely than we originally intended. They have been picked up by businesses, by financial people, by NGOs, by church groups, by all sorts of people who actually have begun to recognize very, very similar things about the existing system and the need to change it. And that has, in its turn, placed a pressure on government to begin to take this conversation seriously, so that although 6 months ago, if you'd asked me, is government responding positively to your message, I would have to have said no. Actually, in the interim, something rather strange has happened, and I am now being invited back into government to have those conversations around these issues again. And that, to me, is incredibly encouraging. I think, along with some of the things that have happened in France, for instance, the Sarkozy Commission report, some of the things that are happening at the United Nations level, all of a sudden, it is possible to have this conversation. And that wasn't the case even 6 to 9 months ago. So that does give me a sense of hope that it's possible now for governments to begin to take this seriously, to open out a bit of space to at least ask the question and have the conversation.
You mentioned the French report. Here in BC, Professor John Helliwell has suggested the idea of gross national happiness as a possible replacement for GDP, the gross domestic product. What do you suggest?
I think the messages from the Sarkozy Commission report and indeed from exercises like the Gross National Happiness are incredibly important. What you measure tends to be what matters. And there is a problem in that sometimes you can't actually measure the things that really matter, and some of the things that you measure don't at all. But at least you should try to get your measurements half decent. So if we're concerned with an idea of prosperity that's built around our capabilities for flourishing as human beings, try to get a set of accounts that gives us some indication of where we're going. And if we pin all our hopes on one very narrow indicator, the gross domestic product, then it's probably no surprise that that doesn't measure this more sense of prosperity. It was never really intended to. So I would absolutely agree with those who say you have to measure more than just the GDP. All the GDP does is it measures the busyness of your economy at any one point in time. That's not telling you whether all that busyness is actually doing anything useful. And if you want the useful bit, then you need to measure feeling in terms of their health, whether they're flourishing in terms of their participation in society, how their sense of trust in the community looks, what their abilities are to participate in society. And that's all implies a different approach to measurement than the one we've had in the past.
The mass media talks about the economic recession all the time, but seldom about the shrinkage of public life. Do you think we have a social recession as well?
That's a part of the strength of the argument, in a sense, is that there are some striking illustrations of a kind of loss of happiness in market societies, as a title of a book puts, the sense that actually all of this material wealth isn't making us better off, and in some cases is undermining a sense of well-being, and it's doing it in all sorts of ways. For instance, by making us a quite anxious, status-ridden society by imposing performance indicators that look good in terms of the economy that actually detract from the quality of our lives, by undermining our sense of community and public goods and social spaces through processes of commercialization and commoditization. And that's well documented over quite a long period of time. And it's being reflected also in some quite hard indicators around mental health, for example. So I think you have to take that evidence very seriously, and you have to take it as a kind of important part of the critique of the existing system. And you have to, if you want to address that evidence, you have to do some very specific things. Addressing income inequality, for example, thinking about public goods again, renewing our vision of public space and social space and what the important role of that is in building community and building social capital. And those are very much part of the recommendations, part of the vision of prosperity in our report.
I can see how politicians and a lot of business people need to rethink endless growth, but what are we to say to the unemployed person? It's hard to simply redefine poverty amid many dashed hopes.
I think it would be absolutely wrong to do that. It would be wrong to say, you guys out of a job and living on the poverty line, that's where you should be. And that's absolutely not what the report is saying, in fact. It's saying that it's about making room for income growth and for livelihoods where they matter. Now, that does present you with some difficulties, and the main one is the difficulty around maintaining employment in an economy which might not be growing as fast as it was. And the question that you basically there, you have two sorts of responses. One of them is to make sure that you have policies which share the available work, so that if there is less work in the economy, then what we do is we take the dividends from our increased productivity as leisure time. And that's a really interesting prospect, not least because that's exactly how the classical macroeconomists, imagined that the economy would unfold, that this wonderful machine for doing things more efficiently would free our lives up from manual drudgery, and we would actually have much better lives with increased leisure and a better work-life balance. So that idea of sharing the work has a very long pedigree, and it's one of the ways that you can approach this squaring of the circle of making sure that everyone in society has something that they're meaningfully doing, that they are employed in some meaningful way. But interestingly, it isn't the only one, and in the book I explore this quite a bit further, because I was slightly discontented with that idea that all we would be doing would be sharing out a limited pot of work. And actually, I think it doesn't quite work like that. When you look at the structural reasons why you can't provide people with jobs unless the economy is growing, you find that this is only the case because we have set up a kind of a fetish, almost a shibboleth around the idea of labor productivity, around the idea that every single activity has to be done with less and less people involved in it, that we're doing things more efficiently, not just in terms of resources, but in terms of people. Because the odd thing about that is that even as the economy progresses, what we're doing is we're systematically squeezing people out of work. And I think that's fundamentally misguided. I think almost in a way it's one of the central structural issues is that this idea of squeezing people out of work in pursuit of labor productivity is ultimately quite destructive. And we have to think in a different way about the value of human labor. There's quite a lot around that that's new to the report, but that's included in the book, because I think it's beginning to seem to me like one of those central issues. People talk a lot, for example, about, especially the people who want to keep growth, talk about a different engine of growth, recognizing that, high carbon materialist growth is unsustainable. They talk about having a different engine of growth. And the closest they ever get to articulating what that growth is to talk about service-based activities, so activities where the content is really about people interacting with other people. And if you want some examples of that, then it's things like, certainly energy service, transport and mobility services, the ideas around community-based health and education, things like refurbishment and repair as activities. And when you look across those activities systematically, one of the things you find is that they provide jobs. They are very good at providing jobs, and that's exactly what we might want of them. But they're not so good in terms of getting rid of jobs, in other words, of giving us increased labor productivity year on year. They actually, again, partly because the heart of what those jobs are is the human labor content of them. So the idea of stripping human labor systematically out of those jobs actually diminishes the value of those economic activities. So the different engine of growth argument is really fascinating because actually those kinds of jobs could be resource efficient, they could be low carbon, they could be embedded in local communities, they could do a lot to support human flourishing, and they would provide lots of work for people in the economy. The one thing they won't do for you is grow the economy. And that's a very interesting point to come out, because it's sort of saying, coming at it from a completely different point of view, saying if we were to start from scratch and define the things that we wanted in economic activity, what would it look like? It would look like these kinds of jobs without the resource implications associated with high impact growth. And that actually has a lot to offer as a vision for a different kind of economy.
We're talking with Professor Tim Jackson. I wonder, can the corporate system, and especially the banks, can they survive without growth? Are you calling for an end to capitalism?
The banks would have to be working in different ways, that's absolutely clear. They would have to be not creating debt in the ways that they are. They would have to be earning their keep in different ways than they are. They would have to be looking at their investment portfolios in very, very different ways from the way they are. And they would have to probably be accepting lower rates of return than the ones that they've been chasing at the high end of the investment markets. So there are radical changes there that have to come down the line. Is it the end of capitalism? I am not sure how interesting that question is. Capital, in terms of stocks of things, natural resources, social capital, human capital, even financial capital, is still going to matter. Investment is still going to matter. It has to operate in a very, very different way. So, you know, if you like, it's kind of, it's capitalism, Alex, but it's not as we know it. And it is a different form of organization of the financial markets.
As we wrap up, is there a particular message you would like to leave with our listeners?
I think that the change is, you know, not only necessary if we're to get out of this, but it's possible, and that actually it offers a prospect of a better kind of life, a life that actually does more justice to what it means to be human and what it means to share in a common endeavor and what it means to live and participate in a society than the one that we have inherited. There is something better out there, and really the entire thrust of this, although driven perhaps by moments of crisis, quite severe crisis, the thrust of it is to say another world is possible, a better life is possible.
Our guest has been Professor Tim Jackson, a top sustainability advisor to the UK government. His new book, published by EarthScan, is Prosperity Without Growth, Economics for a Finite Planet. Find out more at the book website, www.earthscan.co.uk/PWG. And I really want to thank you very much, Tim, for joining us here on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.